Good morning or afternoon, everyone, and welcome to EMForum.org. We are very glad you could join us today. I'm Amy Sebring and will serve as your host and moderator. Now, we will be providing some instructions as we go along for our first-timers so you can relax and participate with us. Now, if you need assistance, you may use the hand-raising button on your participants panel, and Lori Weber will try to help you via the chat panel. Once you have been helped, please do lower your hand. Now, today we are going to learn about some recent changes to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, that's the NRC, rules pertaining to emergency preparedness for radiological incidents associated with nuclear facilities and FEMA Radiological Emergency Preparedness Program requirements. As mentioned in our announcement, the new rules went into effect last December 23rd and are currently in the process of being implemented. A series of forums and workshops have been held around the country to answer questions and resolve issues, and I expect we will be hearing about that effort as well. Now, please note there are several related links on our background page that you can check out later. First, for the benefit of our newcomers, we will begin with an overview presentation, and then we will proceed to your questions and comments. We will provide further instructions just before we begin the Q&A, but we ask you not to submit your question or comment until we get to that part of the program. As you know, we are making a recording, which should be available later this afternoon, along with a copy of today's slides. And a text transcript will be posted early next week. If you're not on our mailing list, you can subscribe from our homepage, and then you will get a notice when these materials are ready, as well as notices of future programs. Now, it is my pleasure to welcome and introduce our two distinguished guest speakers. Robert Kaler serves as Branch Chief of the NRC's Emergency Preparedness Inspection and Regulatory Improvements Branch, where he is responsible for maintaining oversight of the Emergency Preparedness Rule Implementation Effort and Inspection Program. Mr. Kaler has over 33 years of extensive experience in nuclear power, encompassing the areas of emergency preparedness, pressurized water reactor operations, and licensed operator training. And we do have a substitution for Timothy Gretton this morning. We are very pleased to welcome Patricia Gardner, and she is the project manager for the REP program manual, and so I'm sure she is extremely knowledgeable about that topic. Please do, again, see today's background page for further biographical information and, as I mentioned, related links. Now, welcome to you both, and thank you very much for taking the time to be with us. Now turn the floor over to Bob to start us off, please.
Thank you, Amy, for that kind introduction. Amy said, I'm Bob Kaler, and I'm chief of the Inspection and Regulatory Improvement Branch here at NRC headquarters in Rockville, Maryland. By the title alone, it identifies that my branch is responsible for developing regulation and the guidance documents that would accompany those regulations. But I also have underneath my purview the inspection program, which is the inspection performance indicators and also enforcement activities related to commercial nuclear power plants in the emergency preparedness areas. So I always like to say not only do I write the law, I kind of enforce the law at the same time with the area of EP at commercial nuclear power plants. So I'd like to go to the second slide now, next. The topics for today's presentation. My objective today is to provide a background on the EP rule and how it was developed, and then to go forward and explain the rule topics themselves, what actually was changed in the area of EP regulations in the Code of Federal Regulations, Part 50, and also to present the supporting guidance documents that accompany this regulation to assist both inspectors and also industry and other stakeholders on how to interpret the regulation and how to implement the regulation. Slide 3, please. Next. Well, first of all, a brief background of EP rulemaking. This rulemaking was initiated several years ago, actually post 9/11, and it was initiated in order to review and to evaluate what could be enhanced in EP regulations as a result of the change in the post 9/11 threat environment that was previously not fully understood prior to that event. So as a result of that, we had enhancements that were made and issued in 2005 in the form of a bulletin. Those enhancements eventually ended up getting into the rule language, and I'll discuss that later. But also, we saw it as a great opportunity as we were going to go through a major undertaking of EP regulation enhancements to perform a comprehensive review of all EP regulations. And this was the first time this sort of detailed analysis of EP regulations occurred since Three Mile Island, and also addressed a few other issues. There has been a very large outreach effort in this rulemaking, both before and after the issuance of the proposed rule, most significantly from 2005 to 2008, and ending with a 150-day comment period in which, during the comment period, we held 12 public meetings at 6 different locations nationwide here at NRC headquarters in Rockville and near to each one of our NRC regional offices, and also once in Florida, tapping into an NEI forum that was occurring at the same time. A very large number of comments were submitted to both the NRC and FEMA during this public comment period, that 150-day public comment period, of which the NRC received approximately 700 or so comments. All of these comments were considered, and where appropriate, changes were made, and the comment resolution document was issued with the rule. As another outreach effort, the draft final rule language and these guidance documents, the draft documents, were made publicly available while the final administrative steps were completed in order to provide the industry and other stakeholders insights as to what was being provided to our five-body commission for their approval. Next slide, please, slide 4. EP rule background, again, continuing. This slide shows two different bar charts. In a traditional rulemaking, as illustrated by the upper timeline, there would have been only one formal opportunity for stakeholders to comment, and that would have been during a public comment period in which we would place the rule in the Federal Register and seek formal comments. This rulemaking, however, as shown on the lower timeline, offered many more opportunities for staff stakeholder participation. And although we realize this lengthened the time to get the rulemaking out and finalized, this increased transparency and public involvement was seen to be a significant plus on gathering insights into the rule language, implementation dates, and also we're proud to say that our process that we used was one of the processes used for a current initiative at the NRC to look at how to do rulemaking in the future and how to engage off-site external stakeholders from the NRC. So we believe that we were kind of on the cutting edge of it, although it did take quite a while, 6 years actually, from the time that we initiated what we considered to be our rulemaking process until the rule was issued in 2011. But again, we thank anybody, especially anybody in our audience today, that had an opportunity to review and provide us a comment. We do appreciate all comments we receive. Next slide, please. Slide 5. This is a table of the rule changes themselves, and we identified in this table by topics. Now, this doesn't actually identify the regulations that were changed. That, of course, you can find in the final rule in the Federal Register notice. But this table gives 12 topical areas for the changes that were made in the rule and their associated guidance documents that were published along with it. Just to let you know that the first six, number 1 through 6 topics, were related to the post 9/11 enhancements and review that we did. Topics 7 to 11 were a result of that comprehensive review, not a direct result of 9/11. And the last one was an administrative rule topic, and I can get into that briefly at the end. The first rule topic on shift multiple responsibilities was a change in which we are now requiring licensees to perform an analysis of their on-shift staff, that staff that is there 24/7 on Christmas Eve, so on and so forth, to confirm that that staffing level will be adequate to implement the emergency response functions. And we've outlined in our guidance document to them what types of events that they are supposed to analyze and to give consideration to their current staffing levels and to essentially at the end of that analysis phase to adjust as necessary. The next topical area, number two, emergency action levels for hostile action. This actually was in the bulletin 2005-02, and that was issued, that bulletin I was talking about before, it was issued in 2005. And as a result of it, all industry licensees had taken the emergency action levels that were in that bulletin and incorporated that into their emergency action level scheme. And this would be things such as a hostile action occurring at the site, whether it be airborne, landborne, or waterborne, what type of classification would be in the various levels of plant control that were maintained during the hostile action. These EALs were in place essentially at the time the rule was published, but it codifies the requirements such that any future sites would be required to incorporate these EALs. On the next topical area, number three, emergency response organization augmentation and alternative facilities. This is really related, again, for an occurrence during a hostile action event. One of our reviews identified the fact that if a hostile action event was actually occurring at the plant site, that the augmented emergency response organization that would be coming toward the site to aid in whatever type of event was occurring probably wouldn't be a good idea to have them enter the site during a hostile action. So we're requiring an alternative facility for them to go to and also some functional capabilities at that alternative facility. The next topic area, number four, licensee coordination with off-site response organizations. It's also for hostile action-based events. And this was such that the licensee was to be able to identify and provide a description of the LLEA resources, the off-site resources that would respond to the plant site during a hostile action event, such that these resources that were going to respond to the plant site were being considered by the off-site agencies, and also the consideration of how they would be able to implement the emergency plan response, such as the fire brigade, firefighting, or maybe in the areas of traffic control, setup of evacuation centers, so on and so forth. Protection for on-site personnel, the topical number five. This adds consideration of protective actions for on-site personnel during a hostile action, essentially telling them that during a hostile action event, they have to be able to provide protection for on-site personnel, and in particular, those personnel that would be needed to safely shut down the reactor and place it in a cold shutdown condition. The next topical area, challenging drills and exercises, the last one associated with 9/11. The major change that was done there was to include a hostile action event-based scenario during a biannual evaluated exercise, and this has to occur once every exercise cycle. To also state, the exercise cycle was expanded from 6 years to 8 years, and that was to include in order to provide for additional time to conduct these new scenarios. Another type of scenario that we want the licensee, again, I must stress, the licensee is required to conduct during a biannually evaluated exercise, is a no-release or minimal-release scenario. And this was specifically directed by our commission because they wanted to ensure that no preconditioning occurred of the on-site ERO members such that they knew that the scenario would eventually progress to a general emergency with a radiological release and protective action recommendations being necessary. We have done that for the past odd 30 years, and they felt like it was now a time to start looking back and saying we may have provided some negative training, and that's the direction every radiological event at a plant site would take, so you should take actions to be in a position prior to that occurring. So we wanted to include a scenario where that may not be the case, and how would our licensees respond, and we wanted to be able to evaluate that. The third type of new scenario that was provided for was a rapidly escalating exercise to a site area emergency as a minimum. And if they get to a site area and the scenario called for a general emergency, to escalate to that general emergency within 30 minutes, that again was to be able to evaluate the response capabilities of the emergency response organization. In addition to that, we identified certain performance elements that we wanted the ERO to demonstrate, and that also we added that not all scenarios for the exercises must be submitted for NRC review, and I'll stress that's a review, not approval, just for us to have a look at it and to ensure that we were in agreement with the scenario, and if not, that we would provide comment back to the licensee. Of course, it's the licensee scenario to do with it as they see fit, and also for off-sites and FEMA to conduct their portion of the exercise. The number seven item was part of a comprehensive review. Now we're starting with the comprehensive review items. Backup means for alert notification systems. This codifies a new requirement that licensees need to demonstrate. Not that they are in charge of making the actual physical changes, which most often they are, but that a backup capability exists. And that backup capability, of course, is to be evaluated by FEMA, and this is to provide a independent means of being able to alert and notify the public within the 10-mile emergency planning zone other than their primary method. It's not to replace the primary method or to have the same capabilities as the primary method, but it is to have some sort of a backup system in place to both alert and notify. The next area, topical area, is emergency declaration timeliness, something we struggled with the NRC for a while, and a requirement of how quickly a licensee must be able to declare an event. We've always talked to a reasonable amount of time is 15 minutes. Well, now we've codified a 15-minute capability requirement, and I have to say that's a capability, not a performance requirement. So what we look at is how well a licensee, from the time that they receive indication that would have thrusted them into a declaration, how long it takes them to get to the end point of declaring the event, and that process should take them no longer than 15 minutes. So it's really a process type of capability. During an actual emergency, if they take 18, 20 minutes, we evaluate that on a case-by-case basis and determine whether or not it was reasonable to for them to take that time period in order to declare the emergency. Emergency operations facility, item number nine, that is that we are now looking at the performance-based approach to our licensee's EOF. But of course, that's the facility that is the liaison between the on-site activities with the off-site activities. This is normally where the protective action recommendations are developed. This establishes performance requirements for the EOFs rather than a brick-and-mortar type of requirement for the EOF. Evacuation time estimate updating, number 10. This item codifies requirements for licensees to keep their ETs updated regarding population changes, and this is for every 10-year as a minimum for the decennial census, and also to perform an annual screening of the ETE changes as a result of population changes. And also all updates must be submitted to the NRC and also to the offsite organization so they're aware of changes in the evacuation time estimates that the licensee is required to develop. This is also to be incorporated into a part of their protective action recommendation strategy, evacuation time estimates. And this is only really if it impacts the PARs. It may be that the ETEs, even though they may have changed, they do not impact PAR strategies. The last one, as far as comprehensive review, actual rule changes, amended emergency plan change process, and this is the NRC telling the licensees, you can make changes to your emergency plan so long as it doesn't reduce the effectiveness of the plan. And we gave a lot more clarifying statements within the regulation that was out there in guidance area but needed to provide it directly in the regulatory regime. The last item is removal of completed one-time requirements. Most of these were administrative requirements post-TMI. They're now moot. Some of these items, such as you must all submit your emergency plans by December 31st, 1981. Well, obviously, that's all occurred, and that regulation no longer has any, you know, enforcement or compliance requirements associated with it. So that's why we took the opportunity to get some of the regulations off the book, in other words, to say it. Okay, going on to slide number 7. Next slide, please. The guidance documents that accompanied this rule, there were four of them. New Reg CR 7002, which means it was developed by a contractor overseen by the NRC, is the criteria for development of evacuation time estimates. And this provides a technical guidance on what would be an acceptable approach for performing an ETE analysis. We now made them update their ETEs every so often. We wanted to provide them some guidance on how exactly they should be doing that ETE analysis. So we created this new reg. Then the second item is Regulatory Guide 1.219. This goes back to that amended emergency plan change process, basically outlining to them what we believe the process should look like. The ENSER / DPR ISG 01, a lot of letters and a number in there. That's our interim staff guidance document. That's why you see ISG in there, interim staff guidance. And it's basically a catch-all for guidance on rulemaking topics that didn't warrant a dedicated regulatory guide or a new reg. Ultimately, this guidance is going to be incorporated into other regulatory documents, including our current project to revise new reg 0654/FEMA Rep 1. But this guidance document, interim staff guidance document, is meant to provide guidance on all the rulemaking topics that aren't provided in other guidance documents. And then we also are looking at Supplement 3. We did look at Supplement 3, the new Reg 0654 FEMA Rep 1. This was a document on how to develop protective action recommendations, and it was in a draft form that at the time was not finalized. We have now finalized that document, and what you'll find in that document is now an analysis of those strategies, ETEs, and public communications enhancements. Okay, next slide, please, slide 8. Okay, so getting near to the end of my presentation, I'd like to say that, as Amy had stated in the beginning, the EPA rule was actually published in the Federal Register on November 23rd, 2011, and became effective on December 23rd, 2011. And following that implementation date, that effective date of December 23rd, there are various implementation dates for the various topics, and they all differ. And this eye chart that I provided to you on slide 8 and also the next accompanying slide 9 identifies the implementation dates for each one of those 11, I'll say, rulemaking topics. It doesn't identify the administrative topic, of course, topic number 12, because that indeed is a didn't need any implementation associated with it. And, and if you can go to the next slide, please. You'll see that the there's a note on the bottom of that table that talks about those applications that we receive and whether or not they're going to receive a license prior to December 23rd, 2013, or whether they're still in an application process prior to that date and what they need to do in order to incorporate the new regulation. Next slide, please. I'd like to kind of end my presentation a little bit by saying that part of our public outreach that continued after we implemented the new rule was develop a frequently asked question process, which is available on our public website, and you can see the link on the slide presentation. And whenever I believe you're going to publish this slide presentation, you should be able to click on that and go directly to that link. And anybody can submit a question about the about the guidance documents that accompany the EP rule for clarification on issues. It's not meant to give comments on the rule. It's made to ask questions about the rule. And if you care to seek more about how to implement the process, you can contact Mike Norris. He's the team leader that is in charge of the FAQ process. Next slide, please. So as I conclude, I'd like to say thank you for giving me the opportunity to provide you this short, brief background and presentation on the EP rule and regulation. You see my phone number and my email address on here. And if you have any questions about the regulations or the guidance document or anything that you'd like to discuss with me, please feel free to contact me. And at this time, that concludes my presentation. I'd like to turn it over now to Patty Gardner of FEMA, who's going to give you the FEMA side of what occurred during this time period. Patty?
Great. Hi. Thanks, Bob. I appreciate your brief. And Bob and I have been doing this for the last about, year now. So I've been working, you know, with Bob directly, and I really appreciate his brief. I'm going to follow up on a lot of the things that he said in regards to our guidance document that we put out, the REP program manual, that came out at the same time and was very closely related to the EP rule that was put out that Bob just spoke about. And Amy, so I think I just hit next slide somewhere. There it is. Okay. Great. So today I want to talk to you a little bit about the REP program manual itself. And let me step back and actually introduce myself, since I'm obviously not Tim Grutton, the deputy director. My name is Patricia Gardner, and I am the project manager for the REP program manual itself. I've been working at FEMA for 5 years. And I came on board, and they handed me the project, the program manual, and you know, I was really excited to get that because it's really just the one source, one book that has all of our guidance in it, and it's been a great project to work on. So recently in April, we sent out an update to what we had put out in October, and since our document is very fluid and it's a guidance document, we are able to send out updates as they become pertinent. So in April, we just recently updated that, and you can get that on our website, and I'll talk about that, how you can get a copy of the manual, where you can find all that stuff at the end of my presentation. So basically, the REP program manual is a single source document that provides contemporary REP guidance. And really what we mean by contemporary REP guidance is a lot of documents that we had been working from for the last 30 years had been stuff just kind of piecemeal, a memo here and a memo there and a guidance document here and, you know, certain other new reg added, you know, other entities into that. And so we kind of wanted to put everything together so you have a one-stop book that you can go to see what is the federal standard and what is the federal guidance on radiological emergency preparedness around commercial nuclear power plants. So the manual really goes into detail in part two about like amplifying the planning standards that you can find in new reg 0654. And I apologize for the typo in that that title there. It's Aaron Keystrains, I guess, Keystrikes. But that's really supposed to be 0654 FEMA-REP1. I apologize for that. And this book also aligns FEMA offsite activities with NRC regulations and everything that Bob just went through and talked about. We piggyback on that and talk more about how the states and the local communities and local emergency management offices, how they can respond to an incident at a nuclear power plant. So some major changes that have occurred over the past 10 years that, you know, enabled us to update our program were obvious things to many of us in the emergency management community, things such as NIMS and the National Response Framework. HCEP was a very big thing that came out that really solidified what we do here at the REP program with our exercises and things like that, because we're really doing the things that are in HCEP. So transitioning into using the terminology from HCP really wasn't a difficult process for us. Other things such as CPG 101, the camera, of course, was a very big change in some of the things that we had going on. We had to really focus on specific items such as special needs and household pets and things like that, which we're still trying to work out a lot of the kinks with. Then other programmatic changes such as scenario enhancements when it comes to our exercises. What other things do we need to talk about and to actually practice doing, such as a hostile action? And that came out of the, one of the task force that Bob talked about, that we need to actually exercise what happens if there's an actual hostile action at a commercial nuclear power plant. What do we do as the off-site communities around these plants? And also to vary the radiological release. You know, not every time we're going to have something that breaks the EPA protective action guidelines. You know, not every time there's an incident at a plant we're going to hit that. So what do we do in the instances that we don't get that far? Do we activate our full EOCs? And you know, what exactly are we doing? So we wanted to really emphasize that, you know, more realistic things that actually happen. So next slide. Some of the other emerging issues over the last few years, along with the broader DHS initiatives that we, you know, just talked about, were aligning our program with HSPD-5 and subsequently PPD-8. Those were really important because sometimes our program has been pulled out of FEMA and put under DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, and then put back under FEMA. So we really need to secure a position about where we were and how we fell and what we were responsible for under PPD 8 and HSPD-5 and how we were going to actually use those things in our program. Like I said earlier, how we were going to prepare for and respond to a hostile action at a nuclear power plant. Again, enhancing scenario realism and reducing the negative training, you know, that comes with doing the same exercise scenario each time we have one. So for those of you who are not familiar with our program, we have a biennial exercise cycle. And so every 2 years, we would come around and do another exercise at the nuclear power plant and its 10-mile EPZ, emergency planning zone. And it would always be kind of the same scenario where we would always go to a general emergency and have lunch and respond to it and see how it goes from there. And that really had an effect on a lot of our emergency preparedness personnel as, well, you know, it doesn't always have to happen in this specific order. It's going to change, and things, you know, it might get really bad really fast, or it might not get bad ever. So those are the things that we wanted to change. Another important item that we were updating was ensuring that we had backup means for alert notification with every single one of our systems. So that has been a really interesting step forward and something that we're still trying to work with everybody on and getting all, everybody's systems up to date and backed up so that we can ensure that we have all that in place if there was ever an event. As I just spoke about briefly, HCP underneath HSPD-8 and obviously PPD, Presidential Policy Directive 8, has since superseded it. It established HCP as the official policy for all FEMA exercise activities. So anytime FEMA is involved in an exercise, we have to utilize the HCP program, you know, using its methodologies, its terminology, and its documentation standards. So the REP program uses this for all of its design, its development, conduct, evaluation, and its improvement planning. And, you know, it wasn't really a big stretch from what we had already been doing. We had been doing all of these things in the past. It's just we had to conform to the terminology that the federal government wanted everyone to use, the same thing across the nation. And I feel like we've had some really good success with that. At first, of course, there was growing pains, but we've moved on, and, you know, and then we're going to be constantly updating it. There is an update coming out within the next year, and we'll be moving along with that. And so the whole country now together, in concert with the federal government, we're all talking on the same, you know, in the same terminology. along with that, you had the NIMS and ICS. And, you know, HSPD-5 required that federal agencies use this, use NIMS and ICS as a condition to get grants. And though a lot of us are emergency preparedness, the zone, the 10-mile zone around the EPZ, don't necessarily need or actually request grants. However, we still are asking that they use this program so that everyone across the nation is all talking in the same voice. And that's the same thing that really goes with the NRC. And working so closely with Bob for the past few years, I know that the NRC also encourages the licensee to work with our OROs to make sure that they are really talking the same language, even if they are using NIMS and ICS or not. So it's really a great concept that we've been using, and it's great that everybody, you know, be it federal, state, local, and even some tribal areas are all talking the same language, and it really helps out when it comes time to actually exercise or when it comes time for a real event. Hostile action-based scenarios was another thing we introduced with the REP program manual and new reg 0654 supplement 4. Here it states that it starts the new eight-year exercise cycle. It goes into a little bit of detail there that I don't know how much we need to talk about today, but we're currently in a six-year exercise cycle, so within the six-year period, you had so many exercise scenarios you needed to do. We're upgrading that to an eight-year cycle because we've added some additional scenarios that we would like to see and that we feel is really beneficial to our off-site response organizations. The scenario, you know, by December 2015, all of our plants across the nation will have conducted a hostile action-based scenario at the plant, and the off-sites will have practiced trying to, you know, respond to that and see how it goes. Then it goes on to say that we can coincide that with either a full release, a radiological release, so you could have a hostile action-based event that actually, leads to some form of radiological release, or it doesn't have to. It can just be a law enforcement thing. And we're working currently on a checklist that will be able to show our off-site communities what we FEMA will be looking for when we come to evaluate this kind of event. And that's something that we will be constantly updating via our website, and I'll talk about our website in a minute. But this is a topic that we know is new to many people, and a lot of people are, you know, very interested in it, and as are we, and we're trying to help our state and local communities out as best as possible. So if you have any questions on hostile action-based scenarios, I'd be more than happy to take them and, you know, forward them on to the right person. Another area of great controversy, if you will, is the no minimum release scenario that has been added to this eight-year exercise cycle. Basically, it's a no release or an unplanned minimal radiological release that requires the site to declare a site area emergency, but not a general emergency. And we feel that this is quite beneficial to our off-site response organizations and even to the licensee as well, that they exercise what happens when we do not have a radiological release. For the last 30 years, we've been pretty much practicing every time we get a radiological release that exceeds the EPA protective action guidelines. And, you know, from experience and as things have progressed over the last 30 years, we've learned that it's not going to happen every single time. You know, we're going to have incidents where there's an event at the plant that does not end in a release. And we want to see how our off-site response organizations actually respond to that, and what do we do, and how can they handle this situation. So we want to see what happens when field teams report a negative finding. What happens when you have someone go out in the field and they're monitoring for radiation and they come up with something that's below the protective action guide? What do we do there? How does that decision-making actually run through the chain at the EOC? So we're really interested to see this play out. It also reduces the preconditioning of every time an incident happens at the plant, we go to a release. The negative training that we were talking about earlier, preconditioning of things. But it is really important to note that FEMA is not, you know, diminishing any of our requirements. It's still going to be required that, you know, every 2 years we see your decision making and we see your field team monitoring and we see the decontamination, of if anybody was contaminated during an event. Every 2 years, it just doesn't have to be at that one exercise. It can be at an out-of-sequence event. It can be, after that exercise happened, you know, during that week. So we're still keeping our requirements. None of that has changed. We just want to see what happens when, you know, essentially it hasn't gotten that bad. And we want to also, you know, practice the way things are going to actually, you know, that might most likely will happen that way. So the next slide is our actual manual. I'm really trying to get out there and promote the manuals. I have worked on it really hard for 3 years. But the manual really has everything that you need to know about our program, from how we were created to some of the science behind the protective action guidelines, to what we look for in an exercise, how to plan an exercise from start to finish, and all of our reference documents, going back over the last 30 years. It is over 300 pages long, but I feel like it's organized in a fashion where you don't have to read the whole thing from cover to cover to understand what's in it. And a lot of it's just a reference materials. If you go to our website, you'll see on your screen FEMA.gov/library, and then it goes on to view records. That'll take you directly to the program manual. And I don't know if right now the one online matches the one you see on your screen. FEMA is currently going through a website update. And as painful as it has been, they've been a little bit slow on updating our materials. So they have the April 2012 version, though it doesn't look the same. But just know that the material in it is all the same. And we should all be, the FEMA website itself should be fully up to date within the next few months, and so that everybody will be on the same page. We also have a FAQ. And you can see it there at FEMA.gov, and it takes you to the REP program website there. And again, that's a little crude currently. In the new update, it will just all be on your screen, and you can search for a certain word that you're looking for, and it'll be really user-friendly. But that's the FAQ. How it works is if you really have a question about our program, feel free to send it into your FEMA regional office, and it will come to a FAQ committee, and they will talk about it, and we will post the answer to your question on the website. So this is a guarantee that if you have a question, it will be answered within, you know, a few weeks. So I think I've covered the REP program manual. Bob really covered the background about what went into getting to where we are, and I am very interested in hearing any of your questions that you might have, and hopefully I can answer them. If not, I'd be more than happy to take your information and get back to you. So, Amy, thank you very much for the time, and I'll just kick it back over to you.
And thank you very much to both of you. That was an excellent overview. I did, again, want to point out that I believe just about all the URLs that have been shown on the slides today are on our background page. And, Patricia, my understanding is the FEMA library links will not change, so hopefully that one will stay okay. All right, let's get to our Q&A. We've got a little bit of time. Our main point here, folks, is please type your question into the Q&A panel. Please do not use the chat panel to put your question in, and then we'll basically take them in order. I will read the question out loud, and our guests will respond to it over the bridge. And if you can address your question to either Bob or Patricia by name, please do that. Now, it usually does take a minute or two for folks to kind of think about what they might want to ask. One of the things I wanted to ask you both, and maybe I'll start with you, Patricia, and Bob, you can chime in also, is that are you doing more workshops around the country? I understood you were going to try to hit every region.
Hi, it's Patricia. Not more workshops. They've now, not at the FEMA, I guess the federal level, the FEMA regional offices would be more than happy to work directly with anyone that needs, you know, more guidance on this or assistance going forward. So if there is a need or anything, you know, or request for another briefing on this or for more information on this, again, feel free to reach out to your FEMA regional office, and they'd be happy to assist you.
Got it. One of the things, I'm not, you know, from a community that's involved with the directly with the REP program, but I wondered if you could, and I may have missed it in your remarks, Patricia. If I did, I apologize. When they do the exercises, are they done jointly between, you know, the off-site response organization and the licensee, and do they normally do a desktop? How does that work? Just expand on that just a little bit, if you might.
Absolutely, yes. Each exercise done by the FEMA program is a joint exercise. It's a full-scale or a functional exercise done with the licensee, the state is involved, local communities are involved, and sometimes we even pull in some federal players. So it is a very big, robust exercise that occurs around these plants on a biennial basis. So they are quite large and have a really good footprint.
Okay, I'm waiting to see if we've got any more. Okay, we've got some questions coming up now. Good deal. I have one from Matthew Strabe, I believe his name is. He says, with the advent of newer alert and communication technologies, could one of you elaborate on the accommodations for these alert paths in the updated regulations? And I don't know who might want to start with that. How about Bob?
Well, actually, the regulation is written to accommodate. It does not delineate any specific type of means for incorporating a backup alert notification system, and we placed it more on a performance level. But with that, I think Harry, I know you're out there. Harry Sherwood, who is overseeing the FEMA side of ANS backup means. Maybe you have something to offer on that?
Yes, I do, Bob. And this is Harry Sherwood. I'm actually in the room here with Patty Gardner. And the Professional Services and Integration Branch does cover the engineering side of it, and we deal with the alert and notification, not only for backup means of alert and notification, but also the primary means. As Bob pointed out, although, for instance, the traditional means of alert and notification has typically been sirens and the emergency alert system, we are now getting considerable number of requests, not only for backup, but also beginning to look at some of the primary means of some of the other technologies that are out there, including emergency telephone notification systems, everything from the full range of those, the integrated public alert and warning system, or IPAWS, is going to entail. So it's a constantly changing scenario right now because IPAWS is going to be coming online in the coming months and in the coming years, and that's going to have a profound effect on how local communications outlets, including both telephony and broadcasters, are going to disseminate emergency information. And in some cases, there are technologies where IPAWS would actually be able to tie into actual siren systems. So what we are doing is we're in the process of revising our guidance. We call it the REP 10 manual. And as we go along and we're getting requests for consideration of backup means of alert and notifications, What we're doing is having the individual offsite communities, the licensees, if they have questions and need technical assistance, they're sending those requests in through our regional offices, and if necessary, we're providing headquarters technical support for that. So we know that there are new technologies coming on board. We're revising our guidance to accommodate that. That's a very involved process right now. We're getting ready to put out a first draft document to generate initial public comment on our Rep 10 guidance, and we're looking at possibly an entire year for getting that guidance finalized. So it's a combination of putting out formal guidance and working directly with our offsites and with our licensees. But yes, we are accommodating newer technologies and new means of alert notification.
Well, thank you, Harry. And that Rep 10 guidance, that just specifically pertains to alert and warning, or are there other topics in that?
The Rep 10 guidance, there are several documents that that are involved. Those of you who, those organizations that use outdoor warning systems, there is the old CPG 117 guidance on outdoor warning systems. We have also provided update material to our National Preparedness Division for putting out updated guidance on sirens. But the Rep 10 is specifically a guide for the review and approval of alert and notification systems. So although in the past it traditionally has focused on sirens, we're expanding that guidance to look at all alert and notification guidance.
Very good. Thank you so much. I've got a quick question for Patricia from Isabel McCurdy, and she asks whether your REP program manual is available in hard copy. Can that be ordered from FEMA?
Yes. We have currently a contract with the government printing office to provide hard copies. However, right now we're having a minor, snag in the process for printing. However, you feel free, again, I think you can go onto the website and request a hard copy. You will get an email from my boss, Lou DiGilio, that says, we've received your request and we'll send it out to you when it becomes available. We're talking maybe a few more weeks and everybody should be receiving their hard copies. But just know that it's not an immediate process. We apologize for that. But yes, the answer to the question is yes, there is a hard copy.
Okay, very good. Got a question from Lauren Fleming down at FEMA Technical Hazards, and she says she has a hostile action-based exercise in April. I assume you mean this next April, Lauren. When will the HAB checklist be ready? And I'm not sure who would take that. Patricia?
Hi. It's Patricia. I will have to go and ask my colleagues how much longer that checklist will be coming out, but I am pretty sure that you're going to have it it's the whole purpose of having that checklist is to have it before the exercise kicks off. I will double check with you on that for Lauren and find out what the exact answer is.
All right. Thank you very much. Hopefully before next April. We have a question from Eric Daxson, I believe, and Bob, maybe you want to take this. I'm not sure what it means. You may help me out. He asks, is additional guidance being developed for when it is efficacious to exceed 25 REM? Do we know what that means?
Well, I'm not sure where the 25 REM came from. I might be maybe
but let's I'm going to ask Eric to clarify his question for us a little bit. Okay, let's do that. If you just put it back in, Eric, that would help us out. Okay, let's see. I have a question from Lori, Lori Weaver, and she says, please clarify whether all current licensees should be fully using HC process right now, or is there a period of adoption? If not required yet, when will they be required to use the HSEQ? And Patricia, do you want to take that one, please?
Well, if it's the question for the licensee, I'll let Bob, but I don't. I'm just going to let Bob answer that.
Sure.
HSEQ is not a requirement for licensees, just to clarify that. However, because off-site organizations, states, and locals are looking to adopt the HC philosophy, it would behoove licensees to adopt it also, so they are knowledgeable and can also identify how their scenarios and how their programs line up with the HC philosophy. So whenever they're talking to the offsite agencies, they're all talking in essentially the same language. But I don't know if the question might also want to give an answer on how the offsites are supposed to be implementing HC.
Yeah, do you want to touch on that, Pat?
This is Harry Sherwood again, and just to clarify, the HC methodology, it's there have been some misconceptions about it. Currently, all of our regions have migrated into the HC methodology, and there's going to be differences from offsite to offsite because the methodology is very flexible, it's very scalable, so. What it does essentially is it just provides a common platform for how exercises are planned. There's a great deal of flexibility in using that. It provides a whole array of tools that people can use. They're not required to use all of them, but what we do is we strongly recommend it. Now, what it does do is it provides some additional means for documenting exercise results and for tracking improvement planning. Traditionally, we used to put out an exercise report, and sometimes we'd wait up to a couple of years in order to see the results. This is a more flexible process where exercise issues can be tracked, they can be resolved, and we know in real time when they're doing it. But as far as any strict guidance or strict guidelines, it's just like the various states that currently use HC for other exercises. There are many different versions of it. What HCP is essentially a toolkit, and it's a methodology. So there are some things that everybody will use and some things that only a few people will use.
Very good. Okay, we're going to attempt Eric's question one last time. I'm not sure I understand it any better, but we'll give it one more stab. He says the 25 RAM he is referring to is the EPA DHS Emergency Life-Saving Protective Action Guidance, I assume, PAG, I believe that's it. At this point, one of the concerns is providing a rationale for the decision to exceed or not to exceed the PAG for emergency operations. Bob, does that help at all?
Yes, I just wanted to, because I wanted to make sure that 25 REM was the correct number, and, I didn't want to talk about something that wasn't related to the question, but yes, 25 REM is the life-saving PAG in that's identified in EPA 400, and also identified as to when you need to seek senior management approval from the licensee to have that occur. At this time, the NRC, as far as I am aware, is not going to be providing any additional guidance on that. However, EPA 400 is in a review stage at this moment by the NRC. It was provided to us, and it is hoped that that new EPA 400 revision will be issued before the end of the year. And I don't know if it's going to provide any additional guidance in the final product, so I can't, guarantee anything out there. But right now, there's no move afoot within the agency, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, to provide any guidance on that particular topic.
Right. Likewise, with the FEMA side of that, as well as the fact that exceeding any PAG currently, and Harry, correct me if I'm wrong, is really a state decision. If there's a reason or a need to exceed a PAG for any reason for an off-site worker or response organization to do that, that is done at the state level and not at the federal level. But we'll be interested to see what EPA 400 does come out with and whether or not it does discuss exceeding that. I just want to...
Yes, and keep in mind when we refer to the protective action guides, it is a guide, and depending on the jurisdiction you're in, some jurisdictions do have statutory limits on when they can perform life-saving work and exceeding a protective action guide, and some don't. So So that is largely a state and local decision on what emergency responders can do and under what circumstances they can exceed an exposure level and what levels of approval and consent they would need to obtain. So that varies from state to state and jurisdiction to jurisdiction.
Very good. Well, we are out of time, so it is time to wrap it up for today. On behalf of Ava Jean and my associate and myself and all our participants, we thank you very much, Bob and Patricia and Harold. Very glad you could join us today. And
thank you, Amy.
Thank you, Amy.
And we wish you good luck as you move forward with the implementation, and also want to thank your staff for assisting us. Now, for our folks out there, before you run off, if you'll please take a moment to complete our feedback form. It's very helpful, and you can just put more comments in there if you wish. If we didn't get to your question, you can check out the slides to get contact information, and please follow up with these people as you've been invited to do. Okay, now, again, if you're not on our mailing list, just go to our homepage, and there's a subscription box there on the left, and you'll get notices of when our materials are posted and as well as future announcements. And speaking of which, our next program is planned for July 25th, so please join us then. And in the meantime, if you happen to be going to the Natural Hazards Workshop in Boulder, Colorado this week, Ava Jane and I will be there, so please do look us up and say hello. Thanks, everyone, for participating. Have a great afternoon. We are adjourned. See you next time. Bye now.